Manfred had not even bothered to investigate what he intended to destroy. After the first wave of explosions, an infuriated Joseph Vanport transmitted his concession, but Manfred remained skeptical. He glanced at Gilbertus. "What is your assessment, Mentat? Is he trying to trick us, or is he truly defeated?" "I cannot read his mind, but in my estimation of their facilities, ships, and defensive capabilities, Director Vanport has no possible way to win this engagement. He is an intelligent man, and I must assume that he will reach the same conclusion. So it is my assessment that his surrender is sincere and legitimate. Unless he is irrational, or possesses information we don't have." But Gilbertus did not mention that. Manfred Tirando already understood more about irrational behavior than any Mentat ever could. In a remarkably short time, under Joseph's orders, Drago managed to concoct an imaginative plan that took advantage of every possible scrap of material the Thanaris shipyards had to offer. Joseph studied the plan and approved it immediately. "Good. If everything's going to be destroyed anyway, I'd rather lose it while battling those thugs than surrender and watch them dismantle everything." He drew a deep breath, brushed down his mustache. "I want you to announce a full evacuation over the open channel. Make sure it sounds convincing. Then prepare the three ships." Meanwhile, his actual instructions were encoded and sent over a private emergency channel to all loyal Vanhold Spacing Fleet employees. Though he despised the Butlerian tyrant, he opened a communication line again. "All right, you butcher. I'm gathering the rest of my personnel for immediate evacuation. These are good people. Do you give your word they won't be harmed?" Manfred responded with a gaze as inhuman as any expression Joseph had ever seen on a mutated navigator's face. "If they have committed crimes against the human soul, they will face retribution from another judge more terrible than myself." Joseph rolled his eyes before he remembered to maintain his defeated demeanor. "That wasn't my question. Will they be safe?" From the screen, he couldn't tell which of the many warships Manfred was aboard. "Safe from us, yes. Send your three evacuation ships over, and my people will complete our work here without unnecessary bloodshed." Joseph kept his face expressionless. He intended to cause some very necessary bloodshed. He cut off the comm so that his people could keep working in privacy. The three large evacuation ships launched 15 minutes ahead of schedule and lumbered toward the Butlerian fleet. The evacuation vessels were large, refurbished robotic ships, probably an intentional insult from Joseph Vanport. Gilbertus recognized the design and knew how many passengers they could hold, though he didn't reveal his source of information. "I am surprised Director Vanport loaded them so quickly, since the personnel were scattered across the shipyards," Gilbertus said, though he was afraid Manfred would interpret his tone as admiration. "He runs a very efficient operation." The Butlerian leader smiled. "His workers must be terrified. Fear of death makes a man move quickly." Gilbertus frowned as he continued to study the ships, running calculations in his mind. "No, I don't think that's the explanation." His sense of unease grew. "Please ask Director Vanport for the total number of evacuating personnel." Manfred was puzzled but distracted. "What does it matter? We will hold them prisoner aboard their own ships. We can sort it out later. I need to know the numbers. This is important." With a shrug, Manfred nodded toward Inari Idaho, who opened the communication channel again. After a few moments, a flustered-looking Joseph Vanport appeared on the screen. "What do you want now? The three ships are already on their way over." "My Mentat wants to know exactly how many personnel are evacuating." "Why? The ships are on their way. Count heads when they get there." "He is quite insistent." Gilbertus came into view beside Manfred. "Why do you avoid the answer, Director Vanport?" The man mumbled something disparaging about Mentats, then said, 6,283. But that count may not be accurate. I don't know exactly how many you murdered when you blew up our factories. He abruptly terminated the transmission. Calculations raced through Gilbertus's mind. Troubled, he turned to Manfred. That can't be correct. He has not allowed enough time to move that many people. Something is not right here. From the admin hub of the Thanaris shipyards, which he had not, in fact, evacuated despite his transmission, Joseph watched the three large ships arrive in the midst of the barbarian fleet. The big vessels had been built by thinking machines, designed as warships to be operated by robots. The automated systems required no personnel, only a course. Many of his panicked workers had clamored for a spot aboard the evacuation ships, and when he heard their whining complaints, Joseph had half a mind to let them go aboard. But he remained firm and dispatched the evacuation ships. Empty. The half-Manfred thinks that we all believe fundamentally the same as he does. It's his blind spot. Time for him to have a rude awakening. Drago remained silent as he watched the three vessels close in. His voice was very small. My confidence is diminished, sir, now that I know Gilbertus Albans is among our opponents. Joseph flashed him an impatient look. Your teacher doesn't even know you're here. That may be the only advantage we have. The other components of the plan are ready. After a few moments, I can make a more accurate projection and offer additional advice. As soon as... Just then, the phony evacuation vessels exploded amongst the Butlerian battleships, and Joseph let out a shrill whistle. The carefully synchronized self-destruct sequence was impressive. Crowded up against as many of the enemy as they could reach, the robotic vessels blossomed into shrapnel, incandescent gases, and clouds of fuel vapor. The shockwave tore apart 9 of Manfred's ships, while molten chunks of hull metal damaged at least 6 more. I wish we knew which one Manfred uses as his flagship, but this is definitely a good start. Joseph grinned. Commence the rest of the operation before they have time to react. We do not always choose our enemies or allies. Sometimes fate intervenes and makes the choice for us. Griffin Harkonnen, Letter to Lankavale. The desert pilot flew them away from the CH, saying little. Vorian felt mentally exhausted and saddened. Though never a man to give up, he saw little reason for optimism now. One of the freemen had bound up the knife wound in his shoulder, but did a poor job of it, as if he didn't expect Vor to live long enough to heal. Griffin's cut arm was also bandaged. When the pilot dropped them off at the desert monitoring station, he gave them a liter jar of water. Naib Sharnak says you overpaid by this much. Don't waste it. He flew off in the shuddering skimcraft, leaving them behind. Alone in the desert, stranded at the automated weather station, the two men had to face each other with silence and the differing perspectives of their memories. The weather station had been installed in a small bastion of rocks out in the middle of an empty basin, with only a few scattered rock islands dotting the undulating dunes as far as the eye could see. Vor broke open the station shelter, his mind focused on survival. Griffin waited near him, eagerness on his face. Maybe there'll be some emergency water supplies, too. Not water. Not here. They did find a cache of hard ration cakes, which would keep them alive, provided they could summon a rescue within the next few days. Vor reconfigured the equipment in order to send a broad-spectrum burst signal, but the solar-powered station was far out in the desert, by design. Depending on the amount of static electricity, stirred up dust and sand, and storms in their varying stages, transmissions were often degraded to incomprehensibility. Griffin insisted on sending repeated signals, transmitted each hour. Presently, he emerged from the station's equipment shed, wiping his hands. I sent out the signal again, and someone is bound to come soon. If anyone is listening, who can say how frequently these outposts are monitored? Someone's got to be listening. Ford didn't argue. He had been on Arrakis longer than the young man and had seen more of the rigors and hardships. Griffin assumed that someone would mount a rescue operation out of pure altruism, because human beings were expected to help one another. Once Vor had believed that as well, and if this were Kepler, he would have no doubt. But this was Arrakis. At first, Vor thought he had little to say to Griffin Harkonnen, but the young man pressed him for information about Xavier and about Abelard. They sat in the late afternoon shade of the station shelter building. "It's been a long time," Vor said. "A lifetime, in fact. I moved to a different planet after knowing them, became a different person. I locked all those memories away." "Then unlock them." Sitting in the afternoon shadows as the throbbing heat pressed around them, Vor could see the anticipation on the young man's face. He dug deep in his recollections, trying to overcome the obstacle of Abelard's betrayal at the Bridge of Hrethgir, and found that, farther in the past, he still had fond recollections of Griffin's great-grandfather. He could have lied to the young man and fabricated stories to paint a falsely rosy picture of his ancestor, but he wouldn't do that. Vor had gone too far and learned too much to make such compromises. He was beyond lies now. But he did talk about how he and Abelard had fought together against the Piranha Mites that Omnius had unleashed on Seleucus Secundus, how Abelard had chosen to keep his Harkonnen name even when the rest of his family called themselves butlers, how Vorian had promised to help clear the name of Xavier Harkonnen from the unfair disgrace that history had heaped upon him.
"And what about Xavier?" Griffin asked.
"What do you remember about him?" A small smile crept across his face.
"When we first met, we were enemies.
Like us."
"I have many stories about Xavier.
Good stories."
Inside the weather station the following afternoon, Vor glanced at the barometric traces and wind patterns the sensors had collected, but the meteorological data did him little good. In addition to the few supplies and tools, he found a mechanical projectile weapon, a spring-loaded Mala pistol, though he wasn't sure what the gun was for. To drive off bandits, perhaps. His personal shield would protect him against projectiles, but few desert men wore them. He kept the pistol without telling Griffin what he'd discovered. Griffin shouted for him to come outside.
"A rescue ship is coming! Someone got our signal!"
Vor emerged from the stiflingly hot shelter into the dusty heat and saw the young man pointing into the whitish sky. A flying craft with loud engines circled low again, changed course, and dropped down for a landing.
"We'll be safe soon."
Griffin waved his arms, then called back over his shoulder. "You need to get medical attention for your shoulder. If it gets infected, you could lose some of the use of your arm."
The irony of the statement amused Vor. "You were trying to kill me yesterday, and suddenly you're worried about my dexterity."
Griffin turned to Vor with a grim smile.
"Now who's holding a grudge?"
After hearing the young man talk about Lankavale, his plans for expansion of the whale fur industry, the recent disastrous loss of his uncle, and an entire shipment of fur, Vor had decided he might like to visit the planet one day, if permitted to do so. He even considered investing some of his funds into Harkonnen Enterprises, strictly as a silent partner. But thus far he had mentioned none of that. It was not the proper time. Griffin was optimistic, his biggest concern now being how to tell his sister Valya that the need for revenge had been resolved, even if not in the manner she had demanded. The young man hoped that she would accept what he had to say, and he had been working on the way to put it to her. The rescue craft landed with a burst of exhaust and a backwash roar of engines. In the sheltered bowl surrounded by rocky ridges, Griffin ran toward it, waving his hands to attract attention, though the pilot had surely seen him. Vor wondered who had intercepted their signal, and how much the rescue would cost them. Griffin probably assumed it would be free. Vor supposed the young man had no money, but Vor could arrange to access funds through the Venhold Planetary Bank. The engines on the rescue craft died. The hatch cracked open and slid aside. Vor saw two figures inside as Griffin bounded up the ramp, laughing. Hyla was the first to emerge. Though Vor shouted a warning, Griffin didn't have a chance. The young man didn't know her. She reached out to seize him by the neck, and his eyes bulged out, astonished. She lifted him off the ground as he struggled to no effect. Andros emerged from the ship beside his sister, looked dismissively at Griffin, then at Vor. Is this someone special to you?
No.
Hyla's gaze didn't waver from Vor's as she twisted her wrist in an offhand gesture and snapped Griffin's neck, then tossed him aside like an old doll. He sprawled on the sand, twitching.
Vor cried out, "You didn't have to do that!"
Hyla laughed, a rasping squeal like an unoiled hinge.
What does it matter? We came for you, brother.
Andros said, "We have a choice to make. Either we let you join us, so the three of us can recreate the great works of the Titans together, or...
or we just kill you to atone for the murder of our father."
Vor looked at Griffin Harkonnen, who lay motionless on the sands, obviously dead. The young man's slack face showed no pain, only a startled confusion. Turning back to the twins, Vor said, "I don't like either option." He ran. Despite their ability to make extensive calculations, Mentats still have blind spots. Headmaster Gilbertus Albans, cautionary comment to new class. For 3 days, the Emperor's troops scoured the Rossack settlement carefully and methodically, searching for any sign of the computers Dorothea insisted were there. And they found nothing. Worse, Emperor Salvador had made a bold announcement to cheering crowds on Seleucia that he was going to Rossack to destroy the evil computers. His humiliation grew more palpable by the hour. With each failure, Reverend Mother Dorothea became increasingly insistent. The Emperor stood with her outside the entrance to the high cliff chambers, fuming. Directly overhead, the sky hung ominously gray. "On your assurances, I made a spectacle of bringing my imperial forces here, Sister Dorothea," he growled. "You made me launch this embarrassing effort, and I have nothing to show for it." Even the suspicious sisters in her faction had been unable to offer any suggestions. In desperation, the Emperor commanded his troops to go through every tunnel and chamber a second time, while using sonic scanners on the walls to detect hidden passages. Roderick personally supervised the operation. Meanwhile, Reverend Mother Rakella remained calm and instructed her sisters to cooperate in every way. "When will you admit that there's nothing here to find, sire?"
"When I am convinced of it."
He sent her away. During the overcast afternoon, a commercial shuttle arrived with routine supplies from off-world, an innocuous delivery, but the Emperor ordered every container opened and ransacked for forbidden technology, anything he could use to justify dragging his full military to Rossack. His soldiers were growing restless, and the sisters, even Dorothea's allies, showed increasing signs of anger at the injustice. Salvador paced outside of his flagship, gazing at the cliff city, greatly distressed. He hissed from the side of his mouth to Roderick,
"How am I going to get out of this boondoggle and save face? Can't we just smuggle in a few computers here from our junk heaps in Zimia? We have plenty for the next Rampage Festival."
"That would be awkward, brother. No one would believe it if the ships had to fly back to Seleucia and then return here." Always the voice of reason.
"I look like a damned fool," he muttered.
"I should have let Manfred Tarondo come here after all. Let him waste his time searching for things that aren't there." Roderick's brow furrowed, and he kept his voice low.
"Even if we don't find computers, there is still a dire problem here. Anna has been damaged by their negligence, and we both heard Dr. Joma's confession that the Sisterhood wants to cut off your bloodline. Even though Sister Dorothea appears to be discredited, in my mind, she's not. She has proved herself useful at the Imperial Court, and I am inclined to believe her claims against the Sisterhood, even though we have no solid evidence."
"I agree with you.
and I'm thinking of publicly accusing the Sisterhood of plotting against me. Reveal their insidious scheme to render me sterile.
Roderick frowned. No, Salvador, we shouldn't do that. It's not the sort of thing we want in the public record. The Emperor let out a long sigh and nodded slowly.
It is damned embarrassing.
But I need a practical solution. I vowed to come here and smash their computers.
He looked out on his landed ships, his crowded troops, the commanders who had begun to put the soldiers through routine practice drills on the polymer treetops because they had nothing else to do. A waste of time. He needed to put an end to this affair.
Call Sister Dorothea here, and Reverend Mother Rakella. Tell them to bring all the Sister Mentats as well, and line them up before me.
Salvador crossed his arms as he made up his mind. Then inform the sub-commanders to prepare the troops for departure by nightfall.
Responding to the Emperor's brusque summons as the sun lowered toward the ruddy haze of volcanic smoke, the Reverend Mother led old Carrie Marquis and the other Sister Mentats to the Carina flagship. An armed elite guard stood on either side of the temporary throne, which had been turned so that the low sun did not shine in Salvador's eyes.
Dorothea already waited there, unsettled and angry. Raquel's granddaughter had unexpectedly sympathized with Butlerian sentiments ever since her assignment on Lampadus, but she wondered whether the real reason for Dorothea's rebelliousness stemmed more from feeling abandoned. Had Dorothea missed one of the most important lessons? The Sisterhood is your only family now. The Emperor leaned forward on his temporary throne, resting his elbows on his knees. He looked coldly at the 8 Sister Mentats, but focused his glare on Rakella.
Reverend Mother, I despise your highly questionable breeding projections, and I know you tried to prevent me from having children. Dr. Joma revealed everything.
Roderick stood next to his brother, staring stonily at her. Rakella's throat grew so dry she couldn't even swallow. The voices in her mind were as silent as a tomb.
When we departed from the capital, I made a public vow to destroy the computers the Sisterhood uses. I can't go back to Seleucia empty-handed.
Rakella flinched. He appeared to be mortally offended and unable to reveal the true reasons publicly. He had somehow tortured the truth out of Dr. Joma, but Rakella had supreme control over her own bodily chemistry and felt confident that she could will her body to die before revealing anything.
But you have searched everywhere for computers, sire. You cannot find what does not exist. We have only human computers here.
He sniffed. That is only a matter of semantics. They are still computers. A quick nod to the captain of the elite guard, and all the rifles swung down, leveled at the 8 Sister Mentats. Rakella recoiled, and a shout of horror caught in her throat. Beside her, Carrie Marquis raised her hands in the final instant, the oldest living sorceress of Rossack, and Rakella felt a thrumming crack inside her skull as the old woman was hit. A buffeting wave of desperately released psychic energy, a remnant of the power that the most powerful sorceresses had once used to annihilate Cymex. The other Sister Mentats, though, were not sorceresses. Carrie Marquis wasn't enough, and as the Emperor screamed, obviously feeling the mental blast, his elite guard opened fire. The volley of sharp projectiles mowed down the 8 Sister Mentats. The women dropped onto the paved canopy like harvested wheat stalks. Astonished that she was still alive herself, Rakella broke away and ran to the crumpled bodies, where she knelt over Carrie Marquis, who lay in a macabre, twisted heap, her white robe splattered in red. A stunned gasp whispered up from all the sisters who were observing from the cliffs above the landing canopy, and several began to howl in rage or wail in grief. From the cliffs, 5 more sorceresses roared in a resonant howl that echoed across the treetops and in the minds of all those gathered around the school.
To the astonishment of the group surrounding Salvador's temporary throne, the sorceresses leaped into the air, suicidally diving toward the golden imperial flagship. They plummeted, their white robes rippling around them so that they looked like Valkyries swooping down to a battlefield. And then they slowed their descent, using telekinetic control to levitate themselves. With murder in their eyes, they dove toward the Emperor, unleashing another wave of buffeting telepathy. Raquella felt her skull shaking from the psychic pressure, and she dropped to her knees. The target of the assault, Salvador yelled in pain and pressed his hands to his temples with his eyes squeezed shut. Blood blossomed from one nostril. Risking his own safety, Roderick grabbed his brother's arm and tried to help him away from the throne. Struggling back to her feet, Raquella screamed upward as the sorceresses continued their descent.
No! No! Do not attack!
Salvador had collapsed to the ground by his throne, whimpering, so Roderick gasped an order to the elite guard.
Stop them!
Turning their projectile rifles upward, the soldiers blasted the sorceresses out of the sky, causing the white-robed women to fall and crash in broken, bloody heaps among the dead sister Mentats. Raquella sobbed. Salvador reeled, his face wild with pain and shock. As he started to mumble an order to continue the massacre, Roderick grabbed him by the shoulders and said,
"Stop before it goes too far. Enough killing."
Dorothea knelt in front of the Emperor.
"Your brother is right, sire. Please don't kill my sisters."
Salvador sucked in great gasping breaths and finally exerted control over himself. He wiped away the blood trickling from his nostrils, offended by the scarlet stain on the back of his hand. He steadied himself by holding the side of the throne and touched a control at his throat. His voice boomed out from the speaker systems on the landed military craft.
"By my imperial order, I hereby decree that the Sisterhood of Rossak is disbanded. This school will be closed permanently. All trainees will be dispersed and sent back to their homes."
Raquella's shoulders hitched, and she could not tear her gaze from the murdered Mentats or the fallen sorceresses who had only tried to defend the Sisterhood. When she looked at the Emperor, her devastated, hateful expression made him flinch. Roderick Carino quickly put himself between them.
"There is much of value in what the sisters have achieved. I propose that Reverend Mother Dorothea and certain worthy sisters return with us to Seleucus Secundus, where their skills can still serve the Imperium. The rest..."
Salvador seemed glad to have his brother show strength.
"All others are to leave, Rossak. The breeding records will be destroyed, never to be misused again."
He gave orders to his troops, who gathered flame guns from the squadron armory and marched up to the high caves. He turned and looked at the hundreds of stunned women standing at the balconies on the cliff.
"The rest of you must scatter to the winds. Your sisterhood is outlawed."
He looked down at the distraught Reverend Mother, gratified to see how defeated she appeared.
"There," he said. "Now do you think I have a weak and inferior bloodline? Our greatest commanders can lay down the most intricate military plans, but in the end, only God determines who wins each battle. Manford Torondo, The Only Path."
Watching from the bridge of his ship, Manford went white when he saw the evacuee ships detonate, far enough away from him that he was not involved. Several Butlerian vessels had closed in to help them, and now the shockwaves tore them apart.
"Did that madman Venport kill his own people?"
As Gilbertus watched, alternatives raced through his mind.
"I should point out, sir, that Butlerians often take similar fanatical actions."
The legless man responded to the suggestion with horror and denial, and Gilbertus quickly added,
"However, I think it highly likely that those ships were empty, flown by automated systems, and detonated remotely. He and his personnel are probably still hiding in the industrial facilities."
"Then we will find them. I already made my compassionate offer.
but Venport has shown what kind of man he really is.
Gilbertus nodded, continuing his cool assessment. More instructive, he thought, was that Joseph Venport had proven himself to be unpredictable. Such a brash, foolhardy action was unlike anything he had previously done. What was it meant to accomplish? Yes, the ploy had damaged the Butlerian fleet, but not nearly enough to win the engagement. How did he expect to save himself or his personnel from Manford's inevitable retaliation? It was suicide. The Butlerians would never accept his surrender now. It made no sense.
Mentat, say something, Manford demanded.
Recalculating first. Oh, how he longed to have Erasmus here to help. Without warning, the 13 Venhold patrol ships opened fire. The sheer mathematics of the tactical situation should have precluded any aggressive actions. 13 against more than 200, and yet they began to hammer the Butlerian ships. As Gilbertus continued his reassessment, explosions ripped along the side of the flagship. The adjacent Butlerian vessel blew up as its fuel compartments were breached. Not waiting for Manford's instructions, Swordmaster Idaho yelled across the open channel,
"Return fire! All ships return fire at will! Destroy them all!"
The 13 Venhold ships strafed the Butlerian fleet, accelerating faster than expected, and their weaponry was far more powerful than normal vessels of that size. Joseph Venport had made improvements. Gilbertus began to refactor the variables. Perhaps the odds weren't so clearly in Manford's favor after all. The Butlerians had strength in numbers, but their vessels were outdated designs from the Army of Humanity, surplus military ships that were more than 80 years old. Manford Tarondo had never imagined he might face a full-fledged resistance. He simply expected his opponents to surrender to him out of fear. But the ruthless businessman Joseph Venport was not a man to be intimidated. Gilbertus was beginning to understand him better. Then the next gear of Venport's defensive plan clicked into place. Dozens more enemy ships moved out of the shipyards. Half-completed constructions, robotic hulks with barely functioning engines, skeletons of starships. When the Butlerian fleet arrived, Gilbertus had assumed those ships to be inoperable, but when they began to move, he reassessed their tactical potential. A nasty surprise. Venport had far more ships to throw into the fray than it had at first appeared. Per his duty, he presented Manford with a revised assessment. Those are automated vessels, so he will have no qualms about sacrificing them. Anari Idaho gasped.
Driven by thinking machines?
Automated vessels, Gilbertus repeated, without further clarification. The Butlerian leader glared at him.
Why didn't you predict this, Mentat?
Because I did not have complete data.
Use new parameters. I am willing to sacrifice every one of my ships as well. Consider all of my followers and ships expendable, so long as we win this battle. The mind of man is holy.
The mind of man is holy, Anari echoed.
Everything is expendable, sir.
Another contradiction. Gilbertus did not point out how appalled Manford had been when Venport's people made a similar decision.
Except for the life of Manford, the Swordmaster said. That is not negotiable.
Manford was deadly calm as he explained, All-out assaults are how we won Serena Butler's jihad against Omnius and his thinking machines. We can do no less now in this battle for the soul of the human race. Gilbertus studied the pattern of ship movements, retraced the paths, found intersections until all of the possibilities formed an intricate web in his mind. A web that had a strangely familiar pattern. Yes. Right now, Erasmus would have been of enormous assistance. Unarmed, half-completed ships careened into the Butlerian forces, ramming some, scrambling sensors in others, drawing fire like rocks thrown at a hornet's nest. Time slowed to a crawl in Gilbertus's mind as he went deep into Mentat mode and rapidly created his own patterns, revising the projected movements of ships so that he could minimize the concentrations of potential damage. With careful attention, he could unravel the complex tangle his opponent had created.
Gilbertus admired the plan that had been set up against him. It was a shame he would have to defeat it. Panicked and unruly, the Butlerians wasted shots. Several ships picked the same target while ignoring others. To win, we need to be organized, Leader Tarondo. I have a plan, but you must let me guide the shots. Direct your commanders to follow my orders. Do you guarantee that we'll defeat them? The leader asked. It is your best possibility. I see. All right, Mentat. Give us a victory. Once the plans had been set in motion, like clockwork soldiers wound up and turned loose, Joseph could admire what Drago had conceived. We have a chance, Mentat. Look at that destruction. With fascination, he watched the streaking ships, the lancing projectiles, the chain reaction explosions as closely packed Butlerian ships took one another out. Starbursts of fire and debris spread all around the Thanaris shipyards in such great numbers that he could not begin to guess how many barbarian vessels had already been destroyed. He felt sick at heart to lose these grand industrial capabilities. So many ships that could have expanded the Venhold spacing fleet. All that profit turned to vapor and scraps. It was difficult, but in his mind he tried to write off the loss. He could not save the facility or his investment here, but if he crippled the Butlerians, the cost would be justified. Although Joseph noticed no difference in the mayhem around him, his mentat sharpened, intent on the movements of the rival ships. His shoulders fell only slightly. Gilbertus Albans has taken command. I recognize his techniques. I don't see anything, Joseph said. The chaos of weapon fire and colliding ships was impenetrable to him. Drago's eyes flicked from side to side as he processed intricate calculations. We have a small survival ship in the administrative hub, sir. I suggest we depart from this control center. Gilbertus will target it soon. He'll locate us in moments. Joseph couldn't believe what the Mentat had just said. But we're winning. Look at how many ships they've lost. And they still have many more to lose, sir. Now, however, they are operating without restraint, and under such circumstances, the rules and odds change. He looked squarely at Joseph, and there was real emotion and concern in his expression. We cannot win, sir. Trust me. For a moment, Joseph refused to listen. But he had trusted Drago and his plans as much as he trusted Norma Senva. He had always relied on his talented experts, knew he'd be a fool not to listen. If you're convinced, then let's go. Shall I sound the evacuation of any remaining personnel? You can try. We'll have to hope the barbarians let some of our people live. But we both know it's me he wants. Joseph and Drago bolted for the small evacuation craft, sealed themselves inside, and launched from the docking clamp. Joseph glanced at the Thanaris admin hub as they drifted away, saw the frozen body of Arjun Gates mounted outside like a lawn ornament, and felt the great sense of loss. Such a waste. The evac ship wasn't equipped with Holtzman engines, and he had no navigator. He didn't know how they were going to get away from the star system at all, but Drago would make it possible for him to survive another hour, even if in that hour he had to watch the destruction of everything around him. The small ship pulled away from the administrative hub, lost in a flurry of activity as countless vessels whipped by and projectiles raced off pell-mell. And how do you project we'll get safely away, Mentat? The Mentat hesitated for an uncomfortably long moment. I am currently unable to determine that. Joseph felt the heavy weight in his chest. It had never occurred to him that Drago might not have an answer. Moments later, a barrage of projectiles tore open the empty admin hub. Watching the proof of his mentat's conclusions, Joseph felt lost, even discouraged. And at last he recognized the fundamental change that Drago had spotted earlier. The barbarians were reckless, not caring if they had to sacrifice 5 manned ships for every one they destroyed. The human cost was staggering,
but Manfred's fanatics were steadily diminishing the Venhold forces.
We are not going to get out of here, are we, Mentat? It's only a matter of time before they target us.
With no way to fold space, we can't escape.
Drago adjusted the communications system in the evac ship.
I've scrambled the transmission to slow their ability to find us.
Would you allow me to contact their Mentat, sir?
Joseph frowned.
Will he negotiate for the barbarians?
I don't believe so.
But I would like to bid him farewell.
With a sigh, Joseph nodded.
I have nothing more to lose.
As their tiny, unmarked lifeboat drifted among the wreckage and chaos, Drago activated the screen and identified himself to the Butlerians.
This is the Mentat, serving Venport Holdings. I would like to speak with Gilbertus Albans, please.
In moments, his Mentat teacher appeared, not looking at all surprised.
I recognized your tactics, Drago. I'm sorry we find ourselves on opposite sides of the battlefield in a real clash instead of a game.
A Mentat must be loyal to his employer. I've done my best to defend Joseph Venport and to protect these shipyards, just as you've done your best to destroy them.
At the command of Manfred Tarondo, said Gilbertus. Drago wore a defeated smile.
As soon as I realized you had taken command, my own projections showed that even with my best skills, I could not win. You had the better set of assets to use against me.
Nevertheless, I'm proud of you. You fought well. But you understand that this is goodbye, Drago. Manfred Tarondo will not allow you to be taken prisoner.
Your half-Manfred can go to hell, Joseph said.
Manfred Tarondo broke into the channel.
The robot Erasmus wrote that human beings were merely an expendable resource, but it is machines that are expendable. And their allies!
Drago switched off the transmission. Joseph looked at him with heavy eyes.
Any other suggestions, Mentat?
None, sir. I have reviewed all of the known data.
Just then, so close and so suddenly that even Drago let out a startled cry, a large Venhold ship appeared, folding space from nowhere. The cargo bay doors opened up like a yawning mouth in front of the small escape craft. Joseph recognized the female voice that came over the comm system.
Sioba. Norma Senva and I are here to retrieve you, Joseph. We will take you aboard.
Without asking how the two women had known to come here, Drago quickly flew their ship into the hold of the rescue vessel. Below and behind them, the Butlerians had noticed the new ship and turned their weaponry toward it. The first few blasts erupted nearby.
How did you know to come here?
Joseph asked over the comm. In her wavering ethereal voice, Norma said,
They may have Mentats, but I can trump them with my prescience.
As explosions continued throughout the shipyards, Joseph saw that all was indeed lost. Norma Senva's vessel closed its hull like an embrace around their evac ship, and as Sioba ran into the hold to see her husband, the cargo ship winked away and vanished into the safety of fold space.
Persistence is a virtue, but obsession a sin.
The Orange Catholic Bible. The twin offspring of Agamemnon sprinted after him, leaving Griffin's dead body on the hot sands. Vor knew that even if he barricaded himself inside the small weather station, Andros and Hyla could tear through the wall in minutes. Instead, he scrambled up onto the rocks, climbing the loose stone with hands and feet, pulling his way up a boulder field to a small ridge. The open terrain beyond might have been good for meteorological measurements, but it offered Vorian very few options for escape.
Why are you running, brother?
Hyla called.
Convince us to keep you alive.
He didn't answer. Andros and his sister climbed patiently after him, going over the rocks like liquid flowing uphill, defying gravity. When Vor reached the top of the ridge, he regarded the steep slope on the other side that led nowhere except to the empty sands.
Maybe he could circle around and try to scramble back to the twins' landed aircraft, but they had shut down their engines, and he knew the startup and takeoff process would take several minutes. Andros and Hyla would never let him get that far ahead of them. He still had his personal shield and the Mola pistol. The spring-loaded projectile weapon might still function, though he doubted if it would be effective against the twins. Still, the projectiles might delay them. He cocked the weapon and turned, bracing himself. Andros and Hyla were pulling themselves over a line of wobbly boulders that had slid down the slope. Even though, genetically speaking, these were his brother and sister, he felt no hesitation, no remorse. Vor had killed Agamemnon decades ago, and a little more family blood on his hands would make no difference. He had watched these two murder Griffin Harkonnen, a noble young man who would not deserve to die like that. Still climbing, Andros looked up at him and shouted, "At least your wife didn't run when we wanted to ask her questions. But she was an old woman." Vor aimed at the other man's forehead and squeezed the trigger. As shock and horror flooded through him from what Andros had said, the loud report from the Mola pistol sounded like a contained explosion. Vor's aim, or the weapon, was off. A boulder just to the left of the young man's head cracked, and tiny rock fragments sprayed out in all directions. Andros flinched. Hyla stood up, and Vor fired a second time, aiming directly at the center of her chest. This time the bullet struck, and he saw the crater in her jumpsuit, the red ripped flesh at her sternum. The impact drove Hyla backward, but Andros reached out to grab her arm and slowed to help her. She cried out, but regained her strength rapidly. Vor aimed the Mola pistol again and squeezed the trigger. The weapon made only a grinding sound. He tried twice more, but the pistol was jammed. He discarded it. The twins ascended after him again, making even better time now. Thinking fast, searching for alternatives, Vor gazed across the bright, burning sands, where tiny dots of rock protruded at widespread intervals like rotting teeth. The nearest one was nearly a kilometer away. At a dead run across the powdery dunes, he would need at least 15 minutes to reach it, and nothing at all waited for him out there. Still, he had a plan. Recklessly dropping down the steep slope, bouncing from one unstable boulder to the next, he reached the end of the rocks and ran out onto the sand, stumbling across the soft surface. Ishanti had taught him how to disguise his footsteps, how to move without rhythm so as not to attract a sandworm. Right now, however, Vor ran at his natural pace, already panting. He had no water. His supplies were back at the weather station. The twins were coming. They had killed Griffin. And Mariella. Behind him, Andros and Hyla began to descend the slope, closing the gap. Hyla's voice sounded strong as she yelled, "Even if you reach those rocks, where will you run? There's nothing but sand." Vor didn't waste his breath calling back to them. He pulled as far ahead as possible, but it wasn't enough, and they were gaining on him. Halfway to the nearest rocky protrusion, he decided it was time to take his greatest risk, hoping he had enough time to reach the rocks. When he activated the personal shield, it issued a faint, vibrating crackle. Static electricity seemed to charge the dust around him. He unclipped the belt, left the power supply activated, and dropped the shield onto the sand. He ran with even more frantic energy toward the small rock island, unearthing reserves of strength within himself that he didn't know he had. Vor was sure that his rhythmic footfalls had already sent an irresistible summons to a sandworm. Now, with the throbbing shield belt, there should be no question. The twins continued after him, following his footprints across the dunes. Andros called out in his piercing voice, "Look at you running like a coward! You are an embarrassment to Agamemnon!" Vor's throat burned and his eyes stung, but when he reached the top of a dune, he saw that he had almost made it to the solid outcropping. Like an iceberg, the rock's roots grew larger beneath the surface. A few more steps, and he felt rock beneath the sand. He pulled himself higher, panting, and then turned to watch. Andros and Hyla reached the shield belt he had thrown away. They knew they were closing in, and that Vor had nowhere to go beyond his small rock island. The two were so intent on him, that they didn't seem to notice the vibrations in the sand, or the large mounded ripple coming toward them. But Hyla hesitated, sensing something, while Andros picked up the shield belt with a sour frown. He tossed the device over his shoulder, just as a sandworm lunged up from beneath the dunes, its maw open. Scooping hundreds of cubic meters of sand, the creature rose so high that the children of Agamemnon looked like tiny specks falling down a whirlpool. The worm swallowed them. Vor squatted down to watch the sandworm circling the area. Though he was all alone, without supplies, abandoned in the middle of the desert, he felt safe for the first time in a long while. At last he had time to reflect on the trouble he had caused on Arrakis, even though he had only meant to live here in peace. He thought of the people he had recently lost, Ishanti, who had treated him well, and Griffin Harkonnen, an unintended enemy, who might have understood and even forgiven Vorian. And he thought of Mariella. Over the centuries, he had grieved for many losses, but now he was saddened by the waste of these three lives. The Harkonnens had hated him for generations since the exile of Abelard, and he had hoped to achieve some sort of resolution. But once the family learned what had happened to Griffin, he doubted the breach would ever be healed. Sitting on the lonely rock, Vorian felt centuries tired and wished he could just find a place where he didn't have to keep looking over his shoulder. He watched as the worm eventually buried itself and went away, but he decided to rest a while before making his way back to the weather station and the landed aircraft that could take him away from here once and for all. Most public events sponsored by governments are for show. Savvy leaders understand that perceptions are the foundation of their power. Imperial Study of Government Practices. The edict issued by Emperor Salvador Carino allowed the disbanded Sisters of Rossak only a few days to vacate their planet and forsake the school that Reverend Mother Rakella had built over the past 8 decades. He stationed Imperial forces to ensure that his orders were carried out, while he returned to Seleucus Secundus with Dorotea and 100 members of her faction. Rakella was not given the opportunity to say goodbye to her granddaughter, or to Sister Valya. Everyone in the sisterhood was to be dispersed, old and young alike. Only a handful of sisters with important connections could decide where they wanted to go, but most were sent back to the worlds where they had lived before going to Rossak. Being the Emperor's brother did not entitle Roderick Carino to a life of relaxation and luxury. On the day after the Imperial forces returned from Rossak, he longed to sleep late and relax in his bed with Haditha, and enjoy breakfast with her and their children. But the Imperium called. He hadn't slept well, haunted by Salvador's impetuous execution of the Sisterhood's mentats and the disbanding of the Rossak school. Roderick had a great deal of damage to mitigate. He hoped Sister Dorotea might provide an insightful perspective and be willing to work with him. Roderick continued to believe the trained sisters had some value, and he was glad he'd convinced his brother to spare Dorotea's faction at least. Better to save something than nothing at all. Roderick had done what he could to salvage the situation with the Sisterhood. Using funds from Sisterhood bank accounts that the Emperor had confiscated, Sister Dorotea and 100 of her hand-picked followers were busy setting up a new training facility for their order on Seleucus Secundus. There would be no breeding program or Ajar book, and no other publications or programs that had not first been approved by representatives of the Imperial government. Sister Dorotea would bear close watching, but Roderick had always found her valuable. She still had to sort out her personal ambitions from her expressed loyalties to the Emperor. Roderick needed to determine where they overlapped and where they conflicted. As he went about his morning ablutions, preoccupied but as quiet as possible, Roderick considered the numerous critical events he would have to balance. Though his brother had the title and glory of being Emperor, Roderick spent more time implementing policy and ensuring that the government functioned smoothly, despite some of Salvador's rash and ill-advised decisions. Too much had been done, in his opinion, to appease Manfred Tirando and his rabble-rousing followers. Not because Salvador believed in their extremist views, but because they wielded enough power to bully him. Salvador's brash actions against the Sisterhood were clearly an attempt to take the initiative away from Manfred. Roderick didn't deny that anti-technology extremists could cause a great deal of civil unrest, but he was more worried that his brother had made many pronouncements without first consulting him. For most of their lives, Salvador had used him as a sounding board. Roderick wondered what had changed. He sensed a withdrawal on his brother's part, a desperation and a will to survive. Maybe he felt he was losing control of his Imperium. But Salvador was his brother, and the rightful emperor, and Roderick had his own duties. He needed to reassert his influence over Salvador and be a voice of reason before his brother turned into a tyrant. During the CET riots and Emperor Jules's bloodbath against the delegates seeking sanctuary at the palace, they had all seen the price to be paid for allowing emotions and paranoia to run unchecked. But Salvador was not much of a student of history. Ready for the day, though it was not yet dawn over the city of Zimia, Roderick emerged from his private wing and walked down the corridor to the Emperor's private administration offices. He was surprised to find Salvador already waiting for him. Grinning, the Emperor said, "Hurry, come along with me. I've got good news to show you." Roderick fell into step beside his brother. "These days, we both could use a bit of good news." Like an excited boy squirming to keep a secret, Salvador refused to tell him what to expect as they rode in a fast carriage to the large central plaza of the capital city, in the midst of imposing government buildings. There, Imperial guards were already at work cordoning off the area, keeping crowds of early rising onlookers from getting closer. Escorted by gold-uniformed troops, the two Carinos made their way through the people. Roderick smelled an odd, burning odor that irritated his nose. With a stomach-wrenching sense of déjà vu, he stopped to stare at a burned and horribly mutilated body hanging from a lamppost. A thick cable was still twisted around the neck. The extremities had been cut off, the face smashed into unrecognizability, the skin and hair burned. Salvador tugged at his brother's arm, not seeming at all upset. "Come, come, you're going to love this." He lowered his voice to a stage whisper. "It solves several problems at the same time." Though he didn't like any part of what he saw, Roderick went forward cautiously, trying not to inhale the stink of roasted flesh. The placard placed near the mutilated body said in a childish scrawl, "The traitor, Bamoko." "Not another one," Roderick groaned. "I wonder which poor innocent the mobs lynched this time." His brother did a poor job of hiding his grin. "How do you know it isn't the real Bamoko?" "After all these years, and all the misidentified victims, I highly doubt it." Salvador leaned close to whisper, though the hubbub of guards and onlookers drowned out all normal conversation. "It's no innocent this time, brother. Wouldn't you agree that this is a useful way to dispose of Dr. Joma? Two birds with one stone." Roderick's head snapped back, but he stopped himself from responding aloud. Strutting officiously in front of a gathering crowd, Salvador raised his voice, sounding imperious, making sure people nearby could hear him. "We must take this seriously, brother. Perform genetic tests and determine if we have at last found the real traitor Ture Bamoko. It would be good to put this long nightmare to rest. I want you to supervise this matter personally." Salvador's angry expression was quite convincing, even as he whispered out of the side of his mouth, "And I think you know what results I want." Roderick kept his own expression studiously grim, though he felt great alarm inside. "No one will believe it, Salvador. It's not even a matter of genetic testing. The clumsiest autopsy will show that this is a female, not a male. It can't possibly be Bamoko."
The Emperor remained unperturbed.
Oh, you can take care of that. I have confidence in you.
Issue a thorough-looking report, and I'll give it my stamp of approval. Cremate the body and remove any other evidence. Problem solved. Joma has received the justice she deserved, and the mobs can stop looking for their boogeyman. Roderick knew the infamous CET leader was probably dead somewhere on a distant planet, or at least hiding from the small-minded selfishness of imperial politics. Roderick would have liked to be far from the pettiness, but he could not shirk his responsibilities. A Carino did not hide. "Don't worry," he said. "I'll take charge of this mess." Salvador was so pleased that he patted his brother on the back. "I can always depend on you. We're such an excellent team, you and I." The task proved to be, in fact, simple enough. It was a far more difficult challenge for Roderick to see his sister and decide what to do with her. He found Anna wading in a shallow water garden with Lady Orenna, picking colorful floating flowers and putting them in a basket. Standing together in the water, the two women looked like children, and Roderick smiled at them. It was a pleasant contrast to the gruesome spectacle earlier in the day. The silver-haired Orenna, normally quite elegant, wore a simple dress that was drenched from the pool. Anna wore shorts and a dirt-stained blouse. She seemed happy. Watching from the edge of the pool, Roderick said, "You're looking better today, Anna. A good night's rest."
"Flowers for my mind."
With a sweet smile, she held up a beautiful yellow flower with delicate fringed petals.
"Genus Limnanthemum nymphoides, more commonly known as the floating heart. It is a heart for my mind."
In her basket, she pointed to a white and black flower with greenish-purple leaves.
"Genus A. distachius. It smells like vanilla and is edible. Would you like a taste?"
"No, thank you." His stomach remained unsettled from the doctor's mutilated corpse he had recently disposed of. His sister's voice rattled on.
"I can identify every plant in this pond, and every plant in the Imperial Gardens. I know other things, too. The chemistry of the dirt, the origins of the rocks, the scientific names of all the birds and insects. These gardens contain many ecosystems. Until now, I never saw all the wondrous interactions taking place."
Without pausing for a breath, Anna began a scholarly dissertation on the garden, but became distracted when a waterfowl with brilliant emerald plumage flitted by, which prompted her to provide exhaustive details about the region of Seleucus Secundus where it nested and its migratory patterns. Without noticing her change of subject, she began describing planets and star systems where similar birds were found, and soon she was off that topic entirely, talking about the chemistry of cements, mortars, bricks, and other building materials, which somehow led to the mathematics of music. Lady Orenna stepped from the pond, wiped off her feet with a cloth, and said in a low tone, "I'm very concerned about her." Anna continued to ramble as Roderick answered, "Does she still hear the strange voices inside?" Orenna nodded. "She collapsed just before we came here, simply overwhelmed. These flowers seem to be calming her down, though." The older woman sat on a small bench and put her shoes back on. "Her mind may be damaged, but it's also overactive, filled with unsorted information that spews out at random. If she could control it and organize it, maybe our dear Anna's awareness would return." "She's always been smarter than we allowed," Roderick said. "And now we have to do everything possible to give her the help she needs. The Souk School is in disarray. We dare not entrust her delicate mind to their psychologists." He nodded in agreement. "No. I can think of only one place that might be able to understand her condition. The Mentat School on Lampadus. They know more about the human mind than anyone. I'll suggest it to Salvador. And I think he'll agree." Without taking off his shoes or rolling up his trousers, Roderick waded into the water and hugged his sister, as if to protect her from the demons tormenting her fragile mind. In his arms,
She trembled a little, then looked up into his eyes and smiled.
I love you,
Anna said.
Most people aspire to noble actions, but only in theory. When faced with the challenge of implementing their convictions, they shrink from them, becoming pragmatic rather than idealistic. Joseph Venport, Venhold Internal Memo. After Norma rescued him from the disaster at Thanaris, Joseph did not pause to mourn the loss of personnel or ships. Rather, he and Sioba put the entire company, all holdings and subsidiary operations, on high alert. Manfred Tarondo and his insane barbarians were no longer merely an annoyance. The destructive, deadly extremists had to be stopped at any cost. And Venport Holdings was one of the only forces in the Imperium with enough assets to stand against their savagery. Back on Kolhar, Joseph sat in his office trying to quantify the damage and losses. Nearly 6,000 employees dead, including several hundred who had been transfers from Celestial Transport during the takeover. It was possible, though not likely, that some had been captured by the barbarians. Under interrogation, the high-level supervisors could provide important information about Venhold vulnerabilities. He fumed. 13 of his most heavily armed patrol ships had been destroyed outright. 70 recovered machine ships and partially built vessels all turned to scrap. Cargo holds full of sophisticated equipment and heavy machinery, an emperor's ransom in processed raw materials. Everything destroyed. Sioba entered his office and he looked up at her. She understood his immense gratitude for helping him keep his family's commercial empire intact. The marriage had been one of the wisest business deals he had ever negotiated. Today, instead of her usual business attire, with her hair done up neatly under a scarf, Sioba had let her long hair tumble loose to her waist, and she wore a clean white robe that accentuated the pale perfection of her skin. He was startled by her appearance. It brought to mind the image of a fearsome sorceress about to engage in battle with a Cymec. Before he could inquire, she said, "There is another crisis." The words were like a weight dropped on his back. "I don't need another crisis." Sioba stepped up to his desk. "This one we can solve, and it gains us another powerful ally." He sat back, tapped his fingers on his bloodwood writing surface. "All right. Tell me about it." She described the news she had just received about the disaster on Rossak, the Emperor ordering the execution of the Sisterhood's mentats, including Sioba's grandmother, Kerry Marquis, as well as the disgrace and disbanding of the entire order. The Emperor had heard rumors of illegal technology on Rossak, and though he found no evidence, he attacked nevertheless. "Illegal technology. Has everyone gone mad?" All sisters were ordered to leave Rossak. Some have returned to their homes, while others scattered to points unknown. He rose to his feet. "And our daughters?" "They are safe. I've dispatched one of our ships to retrieve them. But there are many other women who need help. Our help." Her dark eyes flashed, challenging him to disagree with her. "In what way?"